Welcome, welcome, welcome to my podcast, everyone. Kyle Tierman here. Hope you're all having a wonderful day. My guest today is Coco Nungalis. Coco is very well known within the big wave surfing community. If you have gone down to surf the massive waves of Puerto Escondido, you certainly know the name Coco Nungalis. He's considered one of the best down there and has traveled the world as a professional surfer. He rode for Hurley and Red Bull for many years. Man, the landscape and life that this guy has traversed is something else. He was born in Mexico City, sold gum on the streets, ran away to Puerto Escondido. I'll let him tell the story in detail, which he had a chance to do here. It's so fucking unique. And one of the reasons that I love podcasts is because it's a medium where we can let these kinds of stories breathe and we can get into the juicy details, which is often where the good stuff lies. So I really enjoyed this conversation with Coco. I hope that you do too. If you'd like to hear more from me, you can sign up for my weekly newsletter. I do a newsletter on Substack just once a week. I ask a question, something I'm pondering, something I'm thinking about, and then write some of my thoughts on the subject. People can chime in on Substack. There's a little community there where people can answer their thoughts to the question. It's just a fun thing to get us to pull back and restrain ourselves from piling head on into the future, and then all of a sudden we run out of road and think, hey, where did life go? I think that questions are a great way to reflect and just take a moment of pause, even just once a week, which is something I'm trying to do in my life. No big secret, doing this whole podcast, doing the newsletter, it's all really just for an audience of one. It's stuff that I would like to be doing more of or getting better at. And I find that whenever I have been able to take on projects that I really enjoy and benefit from myself, and then just am able to share what I'm learning, those projects are the most sustainable for me. Everything else, I tend to quit. So that's probably why this podcast has lasted as long as it is, as it has, is that I don't really give a shit if any of you're listening, because I just enjoy doing it so much myself. But I really do enjoy having all of you reach out when you do say that you enjoy a podcast. That is fun. And you can get in touch with me directly over on Substack. Just click the link below this podcast, sign up for the newsletter, and join that little community. The embers are glowing, the bonfire is starting, and I'm going to stop talking. So please give it up for the one and only Coco Nungalis.
Kyle Tierman here. I'm in Cape Town.
I was the only journalist in northern Nigeria.
Not an adventure until you get lost in Tijuana.
You get caught inside by a giant wave, you feel really alone.
I love the adventure of waking up and not knowing what will happen and that being my job.
I'm standing at a desert oasis right now.
A lot of tourists don't see this part of Bali.
Smiles and thumbs up. Thumbs up.
All right, Coco Nungalis on the mic. Thanks for doing this, man.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me. Yes, I'm thank you.
So let's start with the accident at Todos Santos. What happened that day? Describe the day to me first, and what the waves were like and how you got injured.
That day, it was a day that what the waves were like. It started kind of slow in the morning, and smaller waves, and they were taking, you know, it was taking time for the sets to come, and the waves were, the conditions weren't that good. We arrived there around 8-7 in the morning. I remember we decided to go out until 11 when the switch got, when the wind got better.
Yeah, who were you with?
I was with a Mexican crew of friends, Marcial, Eric, and Quetzal.
All from Puerto?
Yeah. Also, Axel, a kid from here, from Baja. And
so you all flew up from...
Yeah, we all flew up, yeah.
From Puerto.
Yeah, we flew up here, and actually we arrived kind of late, around 10 o'clock in the night, and yeah, you know, do the dawn patrol early in the morning, and do the whole thing, and yeah, we'll.
So, so for people who don't know, you arrive at the harbor in Ensenada area, and then did you take a boat out?
Yes, yes. So, at 5 a.m, we got up from in the hotel, and we get straight to the harbor to embark the boat, and it was around 6 a.m. And then from there, you take a boat to the island that it took us around 40 minutes.
Yep.
And yeah, we got there, and as we were navigating, the wind was onshore, and it was kind of...
junky.
It was junky, and I was like, oh my God, no.
Was it crowded?
It was so... It was probably...
It was a really hyped swell, as I remember.
Yeah, it was probably one of the most crowded days I ever seen.
Right. Because Todos doesn't get good very often, too, so when there is a hyped swell... all the big wave surfers from all over the world want to get it because it's, you know, it is a legit spot and it's a beautiful island off the coast of Baja. So it's, there's really nowhere else like it in terms of scenery and just that you're surfing off of this island. So yeah, I remember there was a lot of media there, and I do remember also that the conditions didn't look great. It was really kind of windy, you know, because it's so exposed out there in the middle of the ocean that it can't handle necessarily a lot of wind. You need to wait for the glassy days.
And exactly. That's it. So, yeah, as we're navigating, so it was kind of onshore. It was kind of not, it was not what they call it. And we got there, and it was, like I said, it was kind of slow. The sets were taking a while to come, and there was a lot of people, and we kind of like decided to wait until 11 because the forecast says the wind was going to change for a better, like a east wind. And yeah, it did. And then around 10:30, the wind started to switch to east, and the wave started to picking up. And then I remember seeing the first couple of amazing rides. One of them was I didn't know Roger from San Diego. He took in one. And then there was another one, amazing ride. It was Cody. Cody, I never met him neither. So name from California, and I see these guys taking off in amazing waves, and the wind switched to offshore, and I was like, okay, let's go. This is the time.
It's on. It's time. And yeah. What size board were you riding?
I had a stretch 10-2.
Cool.
And yeah, we all started to getting ready, and we paddled out around 11 a.m, 10:30, 11, and. It was really crowded, like you say, and probably like half an hour after, later, Jojo paddled out and...
Jojo Roper.
Yeah, and, you know, we say hello, and then he's like, he goes, I'm kind of worried. I'm like, what do you mean? He goes, something big is going to happen. Something big is going to come. I'm like, what do you mean? He goes, yeah, I saw the buoys, just checking the forecast. The buoys are like 22 seconds or something. And it was supposed, the swell was supposed to arrive anytime soon. It was around midday. And as soon as he said that, I'm like, no, I don't want to get caught inside. I'm kind of, so I was a little bit under. So I started like paddling out more deep outside. I moved myself deep outside, but it was not deep enough outside. I thought I was already in a good position, but then like 5 minutes later, a big set came. And many people of us got, you know, we got cut inside by the big set. And actually, I was like on the waves break, the lip and break on top in front of me. So I was like in the impact zone, like right on the spot.
This was the biggest set of the day.
Yeah. And it
caught a lot of people inside.
Yes. And I think that's where you don't want to be. You don't want to be like when a big set comes, you don't want to be right on the spot where the lip. It breaks because that's like the most energy.
Right.
And I was right in there, and yeah, everybody got cleaned up. A lot of people got cleaned up. And on the first wave, I was not going to make it out, and I ditched my board and I tried to dive down and vertical. And so what happened is the wave compressed me, exploded in front of me, compressed me all the way down deep, super violent. And at the same time, so my board was floating, and my board was right in front of the lip. So you can imagine the lip just pushed the board with so much power.
Right. Exploded out into shore.
And at the same time, the wave taking me down deep. So it kind of like opened my legs.
Oof.
Because, you know, the board went that way and I went deep down. And on that moment, I felt that I got injured. I felt something really weird in my hip, my leg, and as I was going deep down, I felt something, and then right away I pulled the vest. I pulled my Patagonia vest, I pulled it, and I was hoping it was going to work, and then at the same time I'm trying to think, I'm like, what's going on? What happened? I feel weird. Something's weird in my body. And I can feel, I can hear in slow motion the inflatable vest under the water is inflating. I was like, okay. And I'm deep down, you know, just holding me deep down. And finally, when I came up, I had exactly like only 1 second to get air. And then the second wave was even bigger. And I was more like a top to bottom wave. And it exploded right in front of me. And it was really violent. Really, really, really violent. On the second wave is when I got hurt like 100%. And I heard my pelvis, and I heard a crack also in my coccyx and in the sacrum crack. And it's taking me violent everywhere. And at this, the board's still pulling me. And then in that moment, I knew like something serious happened to me. Something really serious had happened to me, because I felt like broken in half in my back, in my low back. It was just the weirdest feeling ever. And it was really painful, because the whole time the board is pulling. And I'm already with a broken pelvis and fractured sacrum. And I didn't know what was happening. And I was like, for a moment, I thought I was going to die. Because it was because it was taking me also, you know, I was holding down for a long time, but even though with the inflatable vest. And when I thought I was going to die, and I'm like, no, not today. You know what? Not today. Not today. And I just tried to focus and to keep calm, to focus, to hold my breath and not panic, because that was the only thing I needed to do.
Mm. So is that what you were telling yourself?
Yes, I was talking to myself.
What were you saying?
I said exactly what I said the words. I was like, when the second wave, when I got exploded, destroyed, and taking me down, kind of like a washing machine, but like in 100 steroids, you know? I knew that something serious happened to me. Like my body was broken in half, and every movement was painful as hell. And I had to hold on to the pain, because I could not scream under the water. I had to keep my mouth closed to hold my breath. And like I said, I knew something serious happened. And then at the same time, I'm like, you know what? I'm not going to die today. Not today. Not today. Not today. And I just focus, and I just kind of like let go. I let go. Also, I let go because every movement, even if every movement was painful like hell. So yeah, I was just kind of calm. I tried to be calm from everything what was happening. And when I finally came up from the second wave, you know, like you say, you come up from big beating down, and then you don't know which way is where. I came up, and then I remember I came up looking to the rocks to the other side, and I turned around, and then the third wave. But I remember I lift my hand after the second wave. The first wave, I didn't have time, but after the second, I lift my hand, and I saw the boats far away. And I was like, and then when I came up from the second wave, I remember this, I will never forget. I just felt like I knew I was in really danger, and I was like desperate to get help. I felt like very vulnerable. Like I felt like I really, really bad. And so I the third wave came, and boom, under again. And after I came in the same mentality under the water, just holding the pain, holding the whole time is, can you imagine? I mean, having a board that big, normally weights, I don't know, it's like 7 kilos, 10 kilos, I don't know how many kilos, super heavy. And the power of the weight pulling, the leashes that you wear are super thick. They're not flexible. So it's, the pull is really brutal.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah, feels like 10 people pulling on your leg as hard as they can.
Yes, yes, yes. So, and then when I came up from the third, I remember seeing my board broken. And I lift, and I don't remember if I was the second or third. There was a ski that tried to come get me, but he couldn't pick me up. He says, like, he tried to, I mean, I don't even see so much, but, And then after the third, then the fourth was just like a white water. And then Roger came, the lifeguard from San Diego. I never knew who he was until after. And he comes and he brings the sled and puts the sled to me. He's like, get in the sled. So I try to, you know, get in, like always, you know, you grab it and you just push yourself. But my body was not working. My hip was not doing this. And I said, I cannot get in. And he goes, get in. I said, no, I cannot. I couldn't do this movement. This Oof. Was not working.
Oof.
And then I say, and he goes, you have to get in because you're really close to the rocks and you're going to get pushed. So in that moment, I just drag myself. I drag myself and put my at least my belly, my stomach into the sled. And so we would be able to move into the channel, to the safety zone. And yeah, in that moment, I just felt like right away, I couldn't believe what was happening. And I was really afraid to have something, some kind of injury, like not be able to walk or not, you know what I mean?
Yeah, so you're thinking all through all this when you're on the sled. So right Roger away. Takes you out into the channel. You know you're injured. You don't know exactly what's wrong, but you know something big is wrong. What happens next?
What happened next? Then he pulled into the channel and Greg Long came. Greg Long and with Marcel, and then
was Greg in the lineup or was he on a ski?
Greg was also on the ski. It was Greg. It was Roger. It was like three skis, and they were trying to save people because a lot of people were like
everyone got cleaned up.
Pretty much a lot of people got cleaned up. And he was trying to save some other people. He was saving some other people. Anyways, so he finally came to assist, you know. And right away, he's like, hey, can you know, squeeze my hand? Him and I remember him and Jamie Mitchell. Because they pulled me into close to the big boat where they were coming.
Mm.
So they like, here, can you hold our hand? Can you feel it? Can you squeeze? Okay, yeah, good. Can you, they touch my feet. Can you feel it? I say yes. And then it's like, okay, don't worry. You're going to be fine. You probably got like a broken pelvis or something. I don't know. They didn't say that to me, but I heard Greg was saying that.
Yeah.
But Roger, and I was at the same time, I was kind of like crying in pain. You know, I was like, you know, making noises because it was so much pain. And, yeah, like I said, in that moment, so they did really good. They checked me good, and they put me on the sled, and they, you know, between Greg and all everybody, Marcial, Roger, Jamie Mitchell, Paige, and they all lift the sled into the boat.
Mm.
And everybody, you know, they put me straight into the sled, so not moving. It was like they had to do some, how do you call it? Like a technical move on the water, you know?
Right.
Which is really...
Yeah, lifting a sled
it's from not that easy.
The ski all the way up.
Yeah, it's not that easy. So, yeah. And yeah, like I said, in that moment, I was just hoping that it was not something really serious, like, you know? And yeah, and after that, then the boat, the captain... they came with, he started driving back to the shore to take me, you know, to a hospital somewhere. But nobody, you know, they were like, okay, where should we go? This and that. And then they called the Marines of Mexican Marine. So the Mexican Marine came halfway to meet us. And they switched me again from boat to boat in the middle of the ocean. And then I was on the Marine rescue boat. And then they took me back to shore and went straight to the hospital, to General Hospital here in Ensenada, which I was there for like two or three days without any hope. And it was really tough being in this whole hospital.
Yeah. This is before surgery.
Yeah, this is before surgery. I got there on Friday afternoon around midday, and I left there Monday midday.
Mm.
And I was just there, and they didn't have a clue what I had, and these doctors, for sure, they didn't know how to do this type of surgery, and they were just saying that they were not going to be able to do it. And they didn't react until like the last day. The first 2 days, nobody. I was waiting for any answer, but nobody will come, and it was horrible, man. Yeah, it was horrible. There's a lot of things that I
Were you there alone?
I was there alone. They didn't let me use a phone. I was kind of like, I feel like in a jail because they didn't let me use a phone to talk to my friends or family. And I was only allowed to have a visit for 10 minutes, one person a day.
Wow.
Yes, it was really. And then also when they took me the x-rays, they took me in the bed with the wheels, and then only two people switched me from bed to bed. So you can imagine, you know, these guys didn't have a lot of power. And anyways, one guy from the head and one guy from the feet, they lift me with a sheet and they just threw me into the table of kind of like the aluminum table, yep, you know,
for x-rays.
Yeah. And it was, so my body was like in a hammock, like I needed to be straight.
Yeah.
I screamed so loud and it was so painful. I thought it was, and then I screamed so loud and I said, please no. I see, and then one guy's like, no, hey, why you guys bring him here? What, you guys didn't give him any pain medicine? No, we have to get. But even if they give me pain medicine, that's not the way you move somebody when it's injured with his, you know, the spine or hip, or, you know, you can damage the person worse.
Yeah.
They were not professionals.
Wow.
They could have just really fucked me up worse. Sorry,
yeah,
the word.
Yeah, you could have been paralyzed.
Yes. Anyways, it's a long story, but I lived like a very, very scary and not hope moments in this hospital. And then the last day, actually, on the second day, one of my friends from Ensenada, Pete, he was the only one who was coming to visit me and to talk to me. And these x-rays that they took me from this hospital, he was able to take these x-rays out of this hospital and take him to a very specialized, you know, surgery guy. And he came back and he came talk to me 2 days later. He's like, Coco, I have to tell you the truth, but your case is very serious. And when he said that, I was like, fuck. I was like, you know, like, you, I think what I heard is like, if to be good, you need a surgery to be able to, I don't know, but he just told me you is serious and you need a surgery. And yeah, in that moment, man, I felt again, so my hope was like, and then my last night, I couldn't sleep after this news, and I woke up in the morning, and everything down here was full of blood. And when I saw that my testicles were full of blood, black, I freaked out. The doctors didn't even check this. They didn't check anything, really. And I freaked out. In that moment, I started crying. In that moment, I was like, all these emotions, I just started letting go. And that morning, 7 in the morning, Pete walked in, the last morning, and he saw me crying. And I grabbed him and I said, man, please get me out of here now. Whatever it takes, we need to go to a good hospital. We need to fix myself. Desperate. I was like, please get me out of here now. I cannot be here anymore. I was there for 3 days. I could not talk to anybody.
Yeah, meanwhile, you could have gotten a blood clot. Yeah, you could have lost your leg. Like, you could have become paralyzed. So,
yes.
So where did you end up getting the surgery?
So at the end of the day, Petr told Marcel, and Marcel told Greg Long. He's like, hey, Coco, situation is like this, like this, like this. And Greg was like an angel in that moment because he called, made some phone calls to the States. And then all of a sudden he's like, hey, I got a doctor that he's going to be able to make the surgery for Coco. We just need to get him up here. Does he have his papers, passport, visa, this and that? I say, I had my passport. I had my visa.
That which you may have not brought because you weren't planning on going to the States,
so,
right?
So exactly. This is the story. I never bring my passport, my visa when I come to Todos because I don't plan to go to the States. I just come to Todos.
Yeah.
On that day, I was just coming here for 3 days. And the day I was packing my stuff to come to Todos from Puerto Escondido to Baja, the day I was leaving, I'm like, I saw my in my box, I saw my passport, my visa. I'm like, should I take this visa and passport? I said, you know what? Fuck it, I'm going to take it. I don't know. You never know, I say. I'm just going to take them. Normally, I never bring them with me. And this time, I did. And this time I didn't. It's like, okay, if he has passport papers, bring him now because the doctor's going to go on a vacation the next day or something. So it needs to be now. And when I find out that he was going to, that, I mean, first of all, when I find out that, I was like, and then also when I find out it was the same surgery doctor who operated Billy Kemper, it gave me a lot of hope.
Yeah.
And it changed. And then when I was out of this hospital, Mexican hospital, in the ambulance, and then I went to another decent hospital here in Mexico, and then my friends were able to be there. And then I find out that I was gonna have the opportunity to be operated in California with a really great surgery. I started to be more calmed down, and I was just really happy. And then Greg just drove me across the border with a van, and with Marcel and Marcel's girlfriend Emily. And it took me straight to the emergency rooms in California, and I think it was in San Clemente or Dana Point, I don't remember. And yeah,
had the surgery.
I got the surgery.
Wow.
I got the surgery, and I was there for like 2-3 days. And yeah, and in that moment, you know, I was still ill, but I was more calm.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was more calm that I'm like, whatever it takes, you know. And then, of course, before your surgery, you sign a paper like anything can happen. And you know, it's like a huge surgery, you know, they open in front and this and that. And it was the first time I ever got surgery. And of course, but I was like, man, just trust that everything's going to be okay and just go for it. I didn't have any other choice. But it was a great surgery. They treated me amazing. It was like VIP. It was like unbelievable. Everybody, all the doctors, the nurses, everybody. It was great, great treatment. And yeah, then after the surgery, I spent the time for like 2 months in California doing the rehab. I spent like 1 month in Greg's house. Afterwards, he opened me the doors of his house to just, you know, I needed a place to just, I could not really travel. And at the beginning, you know, the first couple of weeks, I could not really go anywhere. I needed to take care of this.
And sure.
I needed to lay down for the first 10 days. And yeah, so, and then right after that, I started doing my rehabs right away after two weeks after the surgery. I started going to rehabs. Of course, no exercise. I was going with Dr. G, who really took care of me and amazing. They have all these machines that they put you for bringing down inflammation, like red light and all of these things. So I think the first month was all of just bringing inflammation down for scar tissues and all these.
Sure.
All these things. But then, then slowly started working on my rehab and
getting better. So I want to go back in time now.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks for telling me that story. We may come back to it. I want to come back to your childhood. So where were you born? What was your childhood like?
I born original in Aguascalientes. It's a city close to Guadalajara. And then when I was around 4 or 5, my mom moved to Mexico City. And then I was a kid in Mexico City. I lived in Mexico City from 5 to 9 around. And around 10 years old, that's when I run away from home. And
what was your home life between 5 and 10? Paint a picture for me.
My home life was we were living. My mom was married to a man who was my stepfather. He was a technic pilot. We had everything we need. It was not like, but I had really good moments, good memories, but also it was kind of, me and my mom, I was probably not the best relationship, you know? And I remember as a kid living in the house, I was going to junior school, I had friends. But like I say, most of the time was an attention living because me and my mom, we always crush with things. And I used to live with scare, with fear, because, you know, she will get too nervous and just get a little violent, and if I do something wrong in school or whatever. I was never like the really bad kid, you know. I was more like maybe not paying so much attention, maybe more spacing out somewhere, and things like that probably she didn't like, or I don't know. But and there were so many things that it reminded her me of my original father, so, you know, she would get it out on me. You understand?
Yeah.
So, yeah. Anyway,
did you have siblings? Were you only child?
No. I have a sister. She's older. We were living together as well. And yeah. So, anyways, one day I just decided to run away because I just couldn't feel in peace, and I was scared living in the house.
What were you scared of?
Getting hit all the time. So, yeah, I left the house.
You're 10 years old.
I was 10.
Okay. And do you remember having that, a decision or a moment where you decided that you were going to run away from home?
Yes. If I remember what again?
Do you remember a moment, or just like the moment you decided,
yes,
I'm going to run away?
Yeah. I mean, I knew that I wanted to leave. And then I still remember that moment when I really decided to leave, you know. And it was a nighttime, and I told my mom, yeah, I was gonna go buy something, and I never came back. So actually I left like two times. The first time she found me because I was working, I was going in the buses and around her house. There were some buses that go from place to place, and she found me. And now I remember, it was three times. The first time I was in the buses, she found me there and bring me back home, and okay. And then the second time she promised it was going to be okay, we were going to be in peace. And then second time again, the same stuff. And then I ran away, and I knew a bus driver that he offered me to go to his parents to help them to with the sheeps, you know, and the farms. So I moved to this like ranch, to this farm, and I was there for like a month, probably a month or two, and then I got sick from the chicken pumps, or what's it called? When you're young,
chicken pox. Yeah, chicken pox.
Yeah, I got really sick and really really bad, and I got scared. And I remember these people were like old people. They were like, hey, where's your parents? Because you're really sick and you probably need an operation in your throat and blah, blah, blah. And I said, no, where's your... And then the doctors came and said, hey, he cannot be in the sun. He needs to lay down. And I was there like two, 3 days. And then the third day I escaped from this house and I stole a bike to leave. I didn't want to tell nobody where I lived. And I remember in the morning... I left. I stole the bike from the farm where the food, and I was driving from this farm to my house probably like 5 hours, the whole day. And then late afternoon, I arrived close to my house and I grabbed a phone, because back in the moment there was the phones that you put coins,
pay phones.
And I called my mom, and she's like, "Who is this?" I said, "So you are my mom? It's me, mom." And it's, oh. Hey, where are you? And I said, no, I'm here close to the house, but promise me if I come back home, you're not going to hit me. Or, you know, I said, no, it's okay. Don't worry, no. Okay, I went home, and I was home for another month, and the things just didn't feel right again. Everything was back to the same thing, violent, you know. And finally, the third time I left. The third time, that's when I bought a ticket to Acapulco, and I left with another friend from my neighbor. But my friend, after the second or third day, he couldn't do it, and he went back to his house, and I stayed in Acapulco.
Was he 10 years old too?
Yeah, he's probably the same age as me. And
so So you're in Acapulco.
Yeah. Can I take off this?
Yeah, for sure.
I'm getting...
Yeah, you're wearing the sun here. Hold on. Yeah, no problem. So you arrive in Acapulco, step off a bus, your friend bails on you. Now you're alone with really no idea what you're going to do next, but you know you don't want to go back to Mexico City. But you don't really know what to do next. So what do you do? What was going through your mind?
No, I mean, I have no choice. I knew I could not go back.
Right.
I was like, no, I'm not going to go back. I was already committed that I didn't want to go back. And then also, hold on, I'm just going to move here. Also was going to be terrible for me.
Right.
You know, I didn't want to go back. And I was like, no way. And then I was already determined that I was like, no way, I'm not going back. So I stayed there and I started making friends. I got to Acapulco. I'm like, I don't know how I ended up in, I think, like the right place, you know, like the right area where all the, I don't know, I think it was like the area of the nice restaurants and discotheques and all of this and that. And actually before this, I don't remember exactly, but I think I remember meeting some kids' friends that were singing. And I integrated a group with them. One of the guys was playing the guitar, and the other guy was singing, and then I started to learn how to play one instrument.
You learned to play an instrument?
Instrument, yeah.
Okay, so you could make a little money.
Yes. So we were
so like... you perform for tourists,
yes,
and that kind of thing.
Yes, yeah. We were...
And you're like cute little 10-year-old kid. Yes. You could get tips, that kind
yes,
of thing.
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
I was 10 years old, and we were doing this in the buses. Actually, we were doing everywhere, in the local buses and restaurants and the beach. We were just going everywhere.
And where were you sleeping?
On the beach.
On the beach.
On the beach.
Okay.
On the beach, yeah. I did this for a little while. I don't know, for probably a month, too. I don't remember. A couple of months. And then I was more on the beach side.
Mm.
In one area they called Condesa, and back in the day there was like, it was one area was the top restaurants, top discotheques, and it was like the place, you know.
Right, right.
And I started meeting people, and I remember I met this one guy. He was like a lawyer, and he's like, "Hey, where are you from? Or what's going on?" And I went, you know, like he was interested, curious to know my story, and you're different, and blah blah blah. And he's like, "Hey, I want to help you."
Mm.
He goes, "I don't want you to sleep on the beach anymore." He goes, I have like a little home up in town, and I can give it, it doesn't have anything, but you can go there and sleep, but don't bring anybody, just you.
Mm.
But of course, I brought some friends because, you know, I was my friends from the street. We brought the carpet and we were laying down. I lived in this room, in this house for like 2 weeks, and then it was kind of far away. And I remember the second night in the morning, I don't know how some guys came to this house to meet friends of my friends.
Oh, God.
Yeah, but these guys were older. I was like 10 and these guys were like 16. And they started talking about, "No, we just came back from Puerto Escondido, a paradise place and really beautiful. And the surfers, young guys surfing, really..." Talking just about surfing and paradise, and I was just listening to the, and into the whole story, and I'm like, and then, yeah. So
did you know what surfing was at the time?
No idea. I mean, little bit, because there were some other friends that I knew from Acapulco that I went into their home, like guys that have home and older guys. And this guy had like old posters of surfer magazine, of pictures of big waves surfers, you know? And I would be like looking, I'm like, damn, wow, you know? And I was like, also like, you know, and then slowly, you know, guys were like surfing in Acapulco, you know, little waves here and there. And yeah, so anyway, after that, like a couple weeks later, I got caught by the police and they wanted to interrogate me and, you know, asking, they wanted me to say who was stealing, because there was a time they were stealing a lot and who was selling the drugs and this and that, and I really didn't have any clue, you know?
Right.
I mean, I knew that these things were happening because I heard, but And
so let me stop you for a sec. So this lawyer guy who kind of takes you under his wing, you're like, hey, you says you're different. Mm-hmm. I'm going to give you a place to stay. Mm-hmm. What do you think he recognized in you?
I don't know, but that's a good question. I don't know.
I mean, it's kind of one thing that's interesting is that you ran away from home, and then you were able to pretty quickly make friends and start playing in a band. Like, it seems like from a very young age you had charisma and were able to get yourself into situations that other people might not have been able to. Do you feel like you've always been a good talker?
Yeah, I feel like definitely like very social, you know. For me, it's very, since I was a little kid, it was easy to make friends,
yeah.
Easy to talk to,
right.
Hey, hello, I'm not gonna hold back to say something, you know,
right,
and to talk and to make friendship and this and that. So
you could just approach people easily.
Yes. So this, I know I have this since I was a little kid. So maybe, like you said, maybe that was it. Maybe
right.
That was charisma. I don't know.
Yeah. Because I remember earlier you were just mentioning, like, oh, yeah, like, I want to trip with Jack Johnson and Kelly mm-hmm. and take these guys around. Mm-hmm. Like, it seems like that's not a normal thing, right? Mm-hmm. To have that arc, you know, where the amount of people you've met from so many different parts of the world who want you around and want, you know, your perspective, and you're just able to get yourself into situations that most of the time, you know, a little kid born in Mexico City with no background in surf and no connections, it would be very difficult to traverse that kind of landscape, which it seems like you have always been able to do relatively easily.
Mm-hmm. Yes. For me, I feel like it's been like, hey, it's just, I feel like I try to look everybody the same, from the lowest to the highest, and maybe this is why it's been kind of easy for me. I don't really try to put so much, like, you know what I mean? I don't know. I don't know if you understand what I'm trying to say, but yeah, it's like, for me, it's like, I don't have a problem to talk with anybody.
You're unintimidated.
Yes, like, I don't...
Right. You'll talk to Kelly Slater, no problem.
No problem.
Yeah.
No problem. Talk to anybody, no problem, because...
Right.
I understand some people, it's different. I know people that are really, really shy, people that's really hard for them to really be open and to make friends right away. I know people like that. So, yeah. And I think also part of me being outside in the street, I didn't have any other choice.
Right. There's a necessity.
Yeah.
There's a survival skill.
So I kind of grew up with this, you know, and this being a natural part of me.
Right.
Yeah. So
let's go to Puerto Escondido now.
Yeah, Puerto Escondido.
How old were you when you moved there? What was it like?
So what I wanted to say is when I got caught by the police and they interrogated me, it was really, really, really bad. I got really scared. I thought they were going to kill me, this and that. And then after this experience, the next day, I decided that I was like, I don't want to live in Acapulco. I don't want to be here. Where should I go? And like, oh, Puerto Escondido. I remember these guys talking about Puerto Escondido. Paradise. I bought a bus ticket, and I got to Puerto. I got to Puerto around 1987, around.
1987.
Around, yeah. Excuse me. Mm. And when I got to Puerto, it was like, compared to where I came from Mexico City and Acapulco, it was just, back then, Puerto was...
Tranquilo.
A small village.
Right.
Small village. Just nothing happening. Surfing. Only surfing, fishing, surfing. Very small group of friends. And it was, era un paraíso. It was paradise. And I knew the day when I landed to Puerto, I went straight to the beach break. I walked into the beach to Cicatela. I walked from the town to Cicatela. I sat on the beach and looked at the waves. I stared at the waves. The waves were huge. I stared for like a couple hours, and I was like, and there was like two surfers, and I was like, this is what I want to do. I knew that I wanted to be there, and I knew that in that moment, I knew that this was going to be my home forever, you know? I knew it, so...
You didn't know what you were going to do. You didn't know anyone at the time, but you're like, this is going to be my spot.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Did you know that Puerto was such a world-class wave?
No, I didn't know anything.
You didn't have anything to compare it to?
No, I didn't have...
You didn't know that there were... Okay, this is one of the best barrels in the world.
No, I didn't know anything.
And people are going to be traveling from all over... For every surf nation on earth, they're going to come to Puerto Escondido and, you know, Mexican pipeline. It's going to be known. So when did you start going into the ocean? How did you learn to swim?
I started to learn, actually, in Acapulco. I really broke the ice because I was a kid with a really fear with water.
You didn't have fear?
No, like... I was...
You were...
I had fear.
Mm.
Like, I was scared of the water.
Right.
But I broke the ice in Acapulco. I decided to swim by myself in a day, kind of like in a short break with the waves get big. And, you know, when I was with my mom and the family, I was so scared when they would take me to a pool or river. I would not go in the water.
Mm-hmm.
But after a while, you know, I seen my friends from the street and having fun in the beach and... One day I said, okay, I'm going, you know. I decided my own self to walk and to swim. And I remember I got pounded by waves and I was drowning. And some older guy pulled me down from under the water and bring me up. But in that moment, instead of me being more scared, I was like, no, okay, I'm going. And then from there, I was in the water.
Right.
And then when I got to Puerto, I started learning how to surf. And I didn't have any more scared of the water.
Okay.
And I started learning how to surf with half a board.
Half a board.
Half a board.
Broken board.
Broken boards. Okay. Yeah, there was no boards then, and there was just broken boards. There was still single fin boards, a lot of single fin boards.
Wow, so you learned how to surf on a single fin board. Yeah,
there was.
And you were just surfing in the shore break, learning to stand up?
I was learning in... Marinero, back then, there was really good waves in Marinero or the bay. It was breaking little waves after the white water break, getting pushed in the white water, and then Carrizalillo as well. That was a really good place to learn how to surf. And slowly started just moving forward.
Right. Okay. So at that time, were you still just sleeping on the beach?
No, at that time, no. When I got there, I met people from there and... I was asking for work and help, and I got a different types of, you know, kinds of helps. I remember working on a restaurant and also making towel from the floor.
Rugs?
No, the
carpets.
No, not carpets. The floor, the towel.
Tiles.
Tiles.
Tiles. Yeah. Tiles. Yeah.
Making all the color and the mixing the color and the cement and the cemento and the to make the tiles and
right
and working as a fisherman. And then I ended up, and then each people who were giving me work, I would stay in their house or in the hammock. They would give me a place to sleep.
Nice.
And then after a couple of months, I finally moved to a house where one of the first surfers from Puerto, the Ramirez family.
Right.
Mike, the guy who does the dinghy repair, Roger, all these guys from the past.
These are like the OG.
This is the OG guys.
OG, yeah, these guys Puerto were
already,
locals.
These guys were already, OG, Puerto locals surfing there. And so I moved to their home and I was part of the family.
Right.
And I already have a home and I was just helping their mom to do all the cleaning in the house. And I had food and then I started moving like this.
Right. So you start surfing, you start getting better, you start paddling out to Zicatela. You know, let's say now you're in your teens, your early 20s. Were more gringos showing up then, more and more every year? As Puerto, you know, in I guess it would be then the early 90s. Is it starting to get on the map now where gringos are coming down to surf the place more and more?
Yeah, the 90s were epic, man. I mean, when I got there, there was always a group of gringos coming to surf. A lot of Floridians used to go. surfing there, like a lot of East Coast surfers, a lot of Californian, the East Coast, like the Impact guys, Baron Knowlton, Todd Holland. I don't know if you remember these names, if you ever heard about these names.
East Coast guys.
East Coast professionals. Back then, Todd Holland was a professional surfer from OP, really good surfer. Baron Knowlton was a really amazing surfer. And all this crew from Florida used to come a lot. And then also guys from California, Brazilians. Puerto was the Mexican pipeline, you know, like perfect wave. La Punta, empty wave, so good. And all the time, the 90s were epic. All the time surfers from Hawaii, from California, visiting Puerto like never before.
Right.
And the wave was unreal.
Right.
Yeah, so, and then I meet a lot of people, gringos, and then also always they used to see me, and then and I was, they always help me, give me a board, or when they break the board, I have broken board, I put it together.
Right.
We were like super stoked.
Yeah.
We were like, hey, if we can have a broken board, and we will be
we'll
stoked.
We'll fix it.
We'll
yeah.
fix it.
Yeah.
It was like having a broken board from California, like good shape, and
right.
It was like gold for us. And, yeah, and then I meet a lot of people, a lot of surfers, and it was...
How did you get sponsored?
I got sponsored at 17 years old. I was interviewed by Evan Slater in Surfer Magazine for the first time.
I know Evan.
Yeah.
Evan's great.
Yeah, Evan's really great guy. And they interviewed me because they made a trip to Puerto with Alan Johnson, Evan Slater, and... Aaron Chan, a few guys. It was a big day, and I remember I was the only local that I went out, and I paddled out, and I got a decent wave. They took the photos, and all of a sudden they're like, "Hey," they interviewed me, and I came up in the magazine, and then I met Paul Gomez. He came to Puerto Escondido with the Billabong team. He's like, "Hey, you're that kid from the interviews. Yeah, they talk about you crossing the border because." Illegal, and you're going to Hawaii, and you want to live your dream. You know, it has like a story. And then I say, yeah, this is me. And he said, hey, yeah. I want to help you. Come to see me to the hotel. And then
that's what you said in the interview. You said, I want to go to Hawaii.
No. I already made a trip to Hawaii.
Oh, you had made a trip.
At 14 years, I crossed the border illegal.
Oh, wow.
I just wanted, because I met many surfers from California, from Oxnard.
Yeah.
And they're like, hey, come work. And we were like, Puerto back then, there was nothing. And we were like,
right.
Okay. In off season, like, okay, well, let's go work and make money and buy surfboards. And in California, it was always like the mecca of surfing,
right?
Like, where everything begins.
You wanted to check it out.
We wanted to check it out. And we came, wow, as a kid, California was like, but I knew that I never wanted to live in the States.
Yeah.
I just wanted to go
visit, check,
work, make board money, whatever, and then come back home.
So Billabong offered you a sponsorship.
So Paul Gomez offered me to help me make my papers right to come, not to come illegal.
Yeah.
So I did my army service in Mexico for 1 year, and then they sent me a letter, and then somehow I got a visa thanks to the letter from Billabong, from Paul Gomez. Back then it was Billabong. That was my first sponsor. So I started being sponsored slowly from Billabong, but they were giving me clothes, and that was it. Maybe, you know, it went escalated step by step.
Right.
You know, and until I started making money, and I started making my first check, I was 25 years old. I was with them since 18 years old to 25. I started making my first check monthly.
Right.
When they switched to Hurley. And I mean, that was a great time. I thank Paul for so much because he did so much for me. And it was a great, great, great times.
Right. So, you were living in Puerto. You are now breaking into the surf industry in some capacity. You have a very different background than most of the pro surfers that are coming to Puerto. You know, a lot of gringos, a lot of people who grew up, you know, with families living on a beach, more well off. Did you feel like you had to fight for your position as a surfer and in the lineup? You know, Puerto's it's a heavy wave, and it also can be kind of a heavy lineup. And, you know, you were known as one of the heavy locals, you know, someone that, you know, if you're paddling for a wave, other people don't paddle for that wave. How did you kind of develop that mindset, and how do you reflect on it now?
I mean, like you said, at the beginning, I feel like I needed to fight for my position, because also with my own local friends, because, you know, there's, you know, it was a lot of who is the toughest, you know, and if you're too weak, they're gonna smash you, you know. So you kind of needed to stand up for yourself,
even among the Mexican locals.
Yes, you needed to, because there was a lot of ego, you know, a lot of pride, and oh, who is the baddest, and no, fuck you, you know, sorry for the, you know, it was different times.
Right.
It was different times. Now it's different. I feel it's changing a lot.
But so what are examples of that, of like where people were testing you and you felt like you had to be tested?
Yes, people were testing you often.
Right.
And it was not talk, it was action.
Right.
However you could do it, you know? And it was crazy. It was some good times. It was crazy. Puerto back in the early 90s, so it was like the Wild West.
Right. What do you mean? Give me examples.
It was like the Wild West. Que viva, como se era, hold on, in Spanish so I can remember in English. It was like a survival thing. Like, I mean, the Wild West, like, there was fights, like, you know, flying chairs. Like, if you would go to a bar or restaurant, all of a sudden, flying chairs, bottles here, boom, boom, pop, pop. Crazy. Everybody with everybody. I mean, it was really... It was crazy.
So you had to learn how to fight.
Yeah. And on the water as well. So, yeah. You know, so it was really...
Did someone teach you how to fight?
Not until later.
Not until later.
Not until later. But actually, since I was a kid, I remember when I was in the streets in Mexico City working in the buses, I fight a couple of times, and this kid wanted to... He was kind of intimidate me.
Yeah.
Sorry. And... Yeah, I ended up fighting with the guy, and somehow I kick his ass, you know? I don't know how I did it, but I don't know if I was... I mean, nowadays, you know, I don't think I was a really good fighter, but I was fighting with my heart, and I would always, sometimes, you know, many times, will, you know, save myself. But, you know, now, then later I started getting into the jiu-jitsu and boxing with friends, and... And then that's when you realize you don't know anything.
Right. You know, like, when you talk to a professional.
Yeah, then you don't know anything, you know. Yeah.
So who taught you jiu-jitsu and boxing?
One of my best friends, I met this guy when I was 14. He's like 10 years older than me. He's probably 50, he's 57, 55. He's Brazilian, half French. And he's a professor, professor of jiu-jitsu. And he was always into, before jiu-jitsu, he was a black belt, judo. Yeah, and he always liked to fight and box, and then so he started teaching me. I met him since I was 14, but around 23, I started to get into the jiu-jitsu. And playing with the gloves and this and that. What he is the one who really brought me into teaching me some stuff, to the basic stuff. And then, I never really, you know, this is one of the things I kind of regret, because I could, if I would have kept sticking to this since back then, I would be black belt, you know. But there was sometimes, back then also, when he left Puerto, there was nobody
to teach you.
To teach me. And right. Back then there was nothing.
Right.
Now the last three, 5 years now, there's a school, and there's a friend of mine who teaches, and, you know, you can be, how do you call it? Now you can do it consistent.
Classes. Consistent, yeah.
You can be consistent. But back then, And then also, sometimes you get injured, and I was like, no, I don't want to get injured. I want to keep surfing. I want to be focused on surfing.
Sure.
And that was one of the things as well. I was like, I don't want to get too deep into this, because sometimes it's, I mean, do I really need it? I can't. And then you start growing, and then your mind starts thinking different. You know, it's like, man, okay, you try to avoid fights and
right.
All these things. It's not important, you know? And so, yeah.
So, you mentioned Greg Long earlier as someone who helped you get out of the water. When did you first meet Greg Long?
I met Greg I mean, long time ago. I met first his brother, Rusty. I remember meeting Rusty. Around 2001, 2003, something like that. He used to come to Puerto, and then I met Greg afterwards, you know. And then, yeah, around 2003, I see Greg, he come on and off, and he was more focused than Rusty. He was always more focused, and he was more focused and traveling here and there. But yeah, I met Greg around that time. Then we did some trips together to South Africa, and he came to Porto a lot. And
what was your take on him early on? Because he was really young when he got into big wave surfing, and kind of committed to going down to Puerto quite a bit, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what was your first take on him?
What do you mean, first take?
Like, what did you think about him?
I mean, it's surfing wise, professional wise, I mean, he was the guy, the one, he was the guy, you know. When I started seeing his name and seeing what he was doing, I was like, damn, this guy is pretty gnarly, you know. As a person, I never really got to know him until I could never really tell how he was, because I think his personality is really private. I don't know if that's the word. Like, he doesn't show off so much emotions or so much, you know. He's kind of always, you know, so I could not really understand how he was. So I had also sometimes tough moments to really understand him, to see what type of person he was.
Mm.
It took me many years until a couple of years ago.
Mm.
You know, I mean, I always knew that, you know, he, like I said, I was always confused whether he was what type of person he was, but I know his actions were always good, because I've seen a lot of actions in the past with other people. He will react and he will always be there for others, you know.
Mm.
I see this through many other experiences in Puerto with surfers, and he, you know, he was always caring for, and he was always making an action for other people,
right,
that really needed. And this was like, I was like, damn, you know. So yeah, at the beginning, I don't know, I could not really figure it out. So I don't think I was not really close friends until this accident happened to me. Before this accident, there was something that happened, and honestly, you know, now I think about it, and it was something that happened, and it happened for it happened, and I don't regret it. But if I would now have the position to not let this thing between us that happened, I would not let it go. That
what happened?
Deep. You know, it's just kind of like, you know, it's about surfing, about waves, about this and that. And I thought maybe it's a story that maybe I will tell later.
Okay.
In the book. I don't want to, you know, I really want to write this story. But something happened that nowadays I think maybe I could handle it in a different way and not take it too personal. And then, you know, me, my reactions all my life, sometimes I don't think about it. Something that I don't feel kind of right, I don't think about it, and I react.
Mm.
I react emotionally, no racional, more emotional. So I kind of reacted like that. But anyways, after all of these things that happened, the time went by, and you know, sometimes when you know when you do right and when you do wrong, and then there was a moment I'm like, and I'm kind of the guy that in general, in all the problems in my life or whatever, whoever, that something happens, I don't like to drag it and to bring it, carry it all my life.
Mm.
I like to, okay, let go. At some moment, you have to let go. And if you do wrong, you have to say sorry or whatever. If you're right, just let it go. Just, I don't like to carry things, you know. So What I wanted to say was, so after all, 2022, he came, I think that year when you came, that year too, the summer of 2022, before my accident, like 3-4 months before, he came in August, and we talked a little, hey, it's all good, you know, we todo bien. And then he came back again in October, and we were in the water, the waves were really good, and I paddled up to him and said, hey, no, we talk, I don't know. And I said, ah, tomorrow's supposed to be really good. You here, you still? No, he goes, I have to go back to California for work, and man, you should stay. He goes, no, yeah. And then later I say, man, I just wanted to say, it's all good. And so I don't know if I said sorry, and I said, sorry, it's all good. You know, I'm sorry, I was in a different, I feel like I'm in a different path now. I don't know what I said, but I really said it with my heart. And I look at him and his eyes, and I kind of like, and he really, I could see in his eyes that he appreciated this so much. I could see emotionally he, you know?
Yeah.
Because I say, man, I'm sorry, and it's all good. And I kind of give him a hug, or just, and I say, I'm definitely in a I'm in the search for another path in as a person, and it like just let him know that it was that I was letting go everything and then sorry, and I don't know, just I don't remember exactly, but I'm gonna try to remember. But I did go to him and I said, and he looked at me like happy, and I could see his eyes that I make an impact from what I say. And I was gonna keep talking, but the wave came and I said, oh, sorry, turn around, and I left. And that was it. And we were talking, and then it was like a minute, and then the good wave came, and oh, sorry, and I left, and that was it.
Right.
And I didn't see him again until the accident.
Right. So what have been, like, when I see you now, you know, I see you, like, I woke up this morning and walked in the living room, you were meditating. Then, you know, you have a 1 hour breath, you know, breathing and stretching routine. And, you know, it seems like it's kind of the cocoa that a lot of people don't know, maybe, you know?
Yes.
What would you say have been obviously before the injury has caused you to, take rehab really seriously, start thinking about your body and your mind in a different way. And even before that, it sounds like you were kind of learning a bit more about whether it be mindfulness practices or, you know, doing something like apologizing, you know, for something that you maybe felt like you didn't do well. Like, what would you say led you to start gravitating towards some of these practices? Was there any person or any experience where you're like, oh, there's something here to really explore more deeply?
Like if something what made me think like this?
Yeah.
I mean, even before the accident, like I told Greg that day, I say I was already in the search of, you know, something more deeply in life, you know? And of course, I think it's just a different chapter in my life. There's so many things that happened and so many things I regret how I was as a person. But I also feel like not regret bad, but like, you know, there's some things that I could do better for sure. I would do better, but I feel like everything's perfect. It is the way it is because like what I wanted to say is like, for example, after the accident, you know, Greg, I told Greg, I say, when I was in his house, I say, man, you have taught me one of the biggest lessons of my life. And this is one of the most, this is why I want to write this book, not just about my story, but the story, it's him and us too inside the stories, because you never know. And I went back to Portland, I told some of my local friends, the tough ones, and I said, no, man, I say, I have learned, he taught me a lesson, and because you never know who you're gonna need from help, you know? And like, one of the persons that I was probably that I went kind of asshole or kind of angry, too angry. Maybe okay, if I needed to say something, I would have said it, but not like really wanted to kill him, you know. It was unnecessary. But anyways, so one of the persons that, you know, what I'm trying to say is treat others the way you want to be treated, or just treat people good, because you never know. Control your emotions, control all this, you know, because you never know who you're going to need for. At the end of the day, the person who I was kind of not nice in the moment, he ended up being there the most. He was, okay, I mean, for sure he was the number one person who really did, who really made things happen, made it happen with the surgery, made it happen with so many things. He ended up being, so how do you feel, how I felt afterwards? It was like a...
Universe smacking you.
Right? Yes. You know? So I want to take this opportunity, this experience, to share others they don't make the same mistake. You know?
I mean,
so they don't, you know what I mean? Something like we were talking about yesterday is, this is in general, people can relate, you know, maybe on this story, some people.
For sure. Well, I think that our greatest strength also tends to be our greatest weakness. Like, if you grew up very motivated and self-reliant because you had to be, right? If you didn't have your ability to have a really strong attitude that you were going to succeed and no one was going to get in your fucking way, you probably never would have left Mexico City.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And your ability to teach yourself how to surf, paddle out to big waves, get waves that are, you know, as good as most pro surfers in the world have ever gotten, better than, you know, with a way different background, like, that's all because of your mind, right? It's all because of your ability to be like, I fucking got this. And when you have a beating of a lifetime out at Toto Santos and you snap your pelvis in half, you know, that's not the moment to be like, oh, well, maybe I was wrong, maybe I shouldn't be here. Like, that's the moment to be like, not today.
Yeah.
Not today, right? Like, there is a certain resolve that you have always had and a self-reliance that has allowed you to have your greatest achievements, right? But then there are times when that doesn't serve you, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that similarly, like, you know, I know people who have huge empathy for others, right? And they're such good listeners, but sometimes they let others walk all over them, right?
Yeah.
Well, you know those people too, who just, they never put themselves first.
Yeah.
And their strength is that they can feel other people's emotions. They're hugely caring and empathic, but they never are able to get what they want in life, mm-hmm, because they're not putting themselves first. And I think that it's like, life is a path of, it's the middle path, right? Like, right. That's the, you know, the yin and the yang, like, that's, mm-hmm, that symbol, right? Mm-hmm. It's, there is a blend of both things, mm-hmm, that we're always trying to find. And I think that, you know, if you go all in only on your strength and you're not able to see the areas where it doesn't serve you, it's like holding a really sharp knife with no handle.
Yes.
Right?
Well, that's a good explanation, huh?
You need the handle also.
You need the handle.
And I think that that's kind of what each of us has, unique strengths that are our superpowers, things that we can do more easily than others, right? Mm-hmm. For you, you're just like, fuck, I've always been able to talk. I've always had charisma. I've always been sure of myself, that if I set my mind to something, I can do it. Mm-hmm. But sometimes, you know, that comes across as being hard-headed, right?
Yeah.
And recognizing the strength and the weakness in that, I think, is what life is all about, man.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that there's no shame in, you know, a willingness to talk about where we've been wrong. Like, that is just, that's a willingness to grow, You know, if people say that I have no regrets, like, that means just you're just not paying attention. Yes. You're not paying attention to your life if you have no regrets. Regrets are everywhere, but lessons come from those regrets. That's where we are able to grow, is when we're like, fuck, like, I blew that one. Oops.
Yeah.
Okay, but I'm willing to look at it and grow from that experience.
Exactly.
The thing that I worry about, you know, I talk to a lot of people on this podcast, man. Like, I've had like 350 podcasts, and the thing that I worry about is when I talk to people who are not able to reflect on things that they have done wrong. Because I'm like, dude, you're in a scary situation, man.
Yeah.
Because you're just blind. You're driving blind.
Yes.
And it might be serving you right now, but sooner or later, the longer you go down a path where you're not able to look at what you're doing wrong, the steeper the cliff is that you fall off of eventually. And that cliff comes for everyone. If you're not able to slowly down, you know, and kind of create a more graceful path for yourself. Happens to everyone who's not able to look at their shit, dude. Every single person. You look at, and even super famous people, super famous movie star actors, they seem like they have everything in the world. They fucking die alone, dude. People who are unable to have humility. It's a sad story. So personally, I think it's awesome that, you know, that you're able to kind of talk about some of the harder things that you're like, oh man, I maybe blew that situation. I think it shows a different kind of strength.
Yeah, no, for sure. Thank you for that. Yeah, definitely. This is something that I really want to talk about it. Like, I don't care. You know, some people would be like, no, I don't want people to know that I did this and I didn't. I mean, I'm going to say everything I remembered, what it was true, because I really want to make an impact so people can think about it before they react to others. This is why I want to talk about it.
Yeah.
And like I said, I told Greg, I was crying when I left his house, and I said, I was really sensitive too because of the accident and what everything he did. And I told him, I said, he did, if it wasn't for him, this surgery would have never happened. If it wasn't, this cost too of this surgery cost a lot of money. How would I be able to pay a surgery in Mexico or somewhere? And also, if I was going to be operated in Mexico, I needed to have the cash in front, because they don't operate you unless you don't have the money. I mean, he made the difference. And this for me is really important, man. I mean, you know, and then he did so many things. So what I'm saying, when I left, I was like, you have taught me the biggest lessons of my life. And I really want to tell this story out. That's why I want to write this book. I'm going to start writing again. And I want to be really honest. Otherwise, and yes, I want people to see how, because there are many friends and there are many people I don't know that react. Like, I went back to Portland and said, my friends, no, man. It's because my friend would say, no, but this guy said, no, man, just change it. Just leave it. You never know. Life makes us circles, and you might need help from this person. And this, I live experience with Greg, and you know, how do you think I feel afterwards? You know, and yeah. So definitely, I want to tell this story, and it's good to be honest to yourself and to change, to fix everything. That's why this whole experience changed me as well. Yeah. And like I said, before the experience, I was already, like I said, I'm looking for something more deeply, but this one really came to really taught me a lot.
Right. So what's it like, going back out to Todos?
Oh, like this time? Yeah. Oh my God. It was really, definitely really, for a moment I was like, really, I'm here? Like, I cannot believe I'm here. And then, but there was really emotional feelings and memories, like flashbacks coming back. And I was just trying to observe, like, every emotion or that I was feeling. And when I jumped into the water, I felt a little bit like a nervous.
Mm.
Like I felt a bit nervous. And when Manolo told me that they wanted me to lay me down, he was just lay down face up because we want to get you a shot under the water and just relax, just let go. And then when I did that, it bring me back to the moment when I was deep in the water. And I was like, you know, like, no, just relax. And because I remember when I was deep in the water, I said, when I let go and just relax. And it took me back to the moment. And at the beginning, I was kind of nervous because the waves were coming and I didn't want to get caught and this and that. But, you know, like I say, it's been very emotional at the beginning, very facing fears because there are, you know, some fears. And I think it's not just one session. I think, you know, every time I go out on a big day, I'm going to be escalating because it's a process. I don't believe it's just from one day to another. I do believe that it already healed me, that it's healing me some parts for sure. But, you know, I feel like it's going to be step by step. But I think I did make the big step already.
Going back out there.
Yeah, this was the big step. And just to have my brain and to my vision, everything, my body there again was a big step.
Absolutely.
It was a big step. And like I said, and then later after a while, I got a few waves, I started feeling more comfortable. And the whole time I was just thanking God for this moment, thanking the universe, thanking the island, you know, thanking every moment that I was coming back to this place, because actually I love Todos Santos. And I always knew and tell my friends, I say, it's not about Todos. They said, no, don't go back there. I said, no, I love this place. I love it. It's beautiful. It's magical. It's not about the place. So, and then 2 days, before I go to the other days, and then I wanted to go to the island to look for my board, because I've been asking for my board for the whole year and nobody knows anything. And then Chuy, the photographer, told me, hey, is your board? Which color is your board? I said, orange. He goes, does it have twiggy fins? Yes. He goes, I think I saw it on the island. I'm like, really? Why didn't you tell me? I've been asking you for all this. No, whatever. So I went and I told Jojo. I asked Jojo to take me to climb the rock. And I went to the island. I was looking for the board for like 45 minutes and I found it.
No way. Yes. Your board is still on the island.
Yeah, one piece of the board because it broke.
Oh, okay. Wow.
So the tail of the board. So it was three pieces of broken boards, different boards. And I recognized my board because it changed the color. Now it's yellow from the sun, 1 year on the sun. I recognized it from the fins, and it has my name. And I grabbed it, and it was kind of buried on the grass with other boards. And there was even little mouse living under the board. What was I going to say? And it was really good. Really good feeling to see the board and to have it with me because it gave me like a peace feeling. It felt like some part of me, I picked it up, that it was lost somewhere. And I don't know. So, and anyway, it's been a magical trip coming back. They come back to Todos. I've been having a beautiful experience. It's been epic. 2 days, 3 days of surf. The two last days were magical, surfing with a group of friends. Such a great vibe, surfing with Greg, with Jojo, with Kyle, with you, with yourself, and with Nate and Tosh and a few other friends. And just, it's been like, it was magical.
Yeah.
It was magical.
Hear, hear. All right, Coco, that was a hell of a story. And I appreciate you sharing it on this podcast. Thank you so much. I think that's a good place to end. Where can people follow along on your journey? Instagram's the best place.
Instagram. Okay. So far,
cool.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
People can reach out to you if they listen to this podcast and enjoy it. Thank you so much, man. This was a total blast, and really appreciate you sharing all the details in the story. It is a very unique one, and really happy to have it be told here.
Thank you so much as well, Kyle, for inviting me for this podcast, and I cannot wait to hear it later, and hopefully some people get inspired or motivated or something. That's the idea. And thank you so much again. And looking forward to see you again and surf with you together.
All right, buddy.
All right, brother.
That's our show. Before you head off into your day, you can go to tierman.substack.com to get my newsletter, my articles, thoughts, ramblings. If you want to hear more from me, tierman.substack.com is the place to be. That's it for now. Thank you so much for tuning in. Get out in the water, whatever body of water is closest to you, lake, river, bathtub, or ocean. I promise it will make your day better. See you soon.